Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Welcome, everybody, to this week's exciting episode.
It's awfully chilly in Minnesota, don't you know?
That's a Canadian accent in Minnesota.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. I think it's from the film Fargo, or the series Fargo.
Oh, okay.
If you remember that. That was big about 8 years ago.
I remember it. I don't think I ever actually watched it, to be honest.
Yeah, it's one of them classic accents that I can say a couple sentences and then I lose it after a while.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, you manage about 15 words and then it slips into Indian or something.
Yeah. I usually go from Irish to Scottish to all sorts.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is awfully chilly in Minnesota.
That is one of the northern states, isn't it?
I believe so, yeah. I think it's close to Canada. I know they get snow, so I'm pretty sure it's one of the colder states.
Yeah, I think it's, don't quote me on this, but I think it is one of the northern ones up sort of near Michigan and all that, sort of the Great Lakes.
I should know, because I'm half American.
Maybe a little bit
further
west, I think. I'm not entirely sure.
I know their team is the Minnesota Vikings, and they wear purple, so could be your team.
Having never been to America, my geography is not great on on national states over there. But anyway, what have you got for us today, Josh?
Well, let me take you back to the weekend. So,
oh, please don't. It was a horrendous weekend.
I'll take you back and tell you a little story as to why we're doing today's subject.
Okay.
Just a quick one.
Yeah.
So I won't mention names because obviously I don't know if people will want me mentioning about this.
Yeah.
Essentially, long story short, I was talking to a friend that I went to school with.
Called Dave.
I mean, that's very similar to his actual name.
It's not his name, though, so we're just going to call him Dave.
Yeah, okay, Dave. And he'd bumped into someone else that we went to school with. Let's call her Susan.
Susan. Dave and Susan, yeah.
And essentially, they got talking and catching up like you do with old school friends.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Oh, what have you been up to? And this, that, and the other. And he found out that she had a little bit of money and
let that on then?
It turns out she had sold her body to science.
Oh.
So
it's better than selling your body to other things, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know actually with the stories I've got.
Maybe not.
essentially she was doing medical trials and was getting paid fairly well for them.
Some of them I think do, some of them don't. I've seen adverts for it. I almost got tempted by it a couple of times myself, but I'm not that risk much of a risk taker.
When we go into it at the end, I'll ask you if you think you would be more likely to do it or less likely to do it with the stories, because I've got some good, some bad.
But I think with my lifestyle, I don't think they'd accept me.
They wouldn't. That will come up into it. But today we are doing human medical and clinical trials.
Ooh.
Experiments on humans and things. So that's what we're getting into.
Not quite a conspiracy theory.
No, this is actually happening, and it has happened.
And it's not paranormal.
No, no. I just found
it. Why are we doing it?
We're doing it because it's weird.
And interesting.
And interesting, yeah. Right, okay. And we cover weird and interesting things.
Yeah, it falls under our scope, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I generally, when he was talking to me about it, I was just fascinated. And I was going to do El Chupacabra, but I'm going to save that for another day. And I just couldn't get this out of my head. So I thought, I'm going to do some research and I'm going to do a podcast on it. Why not? I think it's weird, interesting, wonderful. And yeah, so...
Mate, if we find it interesting, other people probably find it interesting. So
I hope so.
That's all we need to
cover
it.
I've got 8 pages of research on it, so I hope people
find it interesting, didn't you?
Yeah. So... Have a guess. I'm going to cover the data. When do you think the first recorded history of clinical trials dates back to?
Clinical. I would probably put it around the late 19th century, with like all the body snatchers and that sort of thing going on.
Well, 500 BC.
Really?
Yeah.
Good grief.
That is the first kind of record. Well, I say recorded.
Who by?
That's the thing. There's no information really on it. They just think that it started 500 BC.
What would the Egyptians or the Greeks or?
I'm not too sure. No, I just typed in on search engine the first clinical trial, and it just kept coming up saying that it hasn't been proven, but there's evidence that it dates back to 500 BC.
Okay, so, fair enough.
But we're not going to reflect too much on that because, like I said, there's no real evidence of it. So I'm just going to go back to basically the last 275 years is how long this has been going.
Okay, well, that's a little bit longer than what I said.
Yeah, so as we know it, clinical trials have been going on since, the last 275 years, basically. And the reason for it is to create opportunities for physicians to find viable treatments for a range of conditions. The summary of it.
Yeah.
And in the last 275 years of what I'll call the modern trials, there's been a lot of challenges, but there's also been a lot of triumphs, and some things have been found by accident. So
a lot of things have been found by it. Even the invention of penicillin was accidental.
Yes, yeah, it was. That hasn't come up, so you're all right to mention that. Yeah, but that you are right. Penicillin was a complete accident. And I'm going to take you back to the first one, which was in 1747.
Wow, okay, yeah.
And this was it was considered the first controlled clinical trial in modern times, and it was Dr. James Lind, who was Scottish.
Was this for pharmaceutical chemicals, like drugs, or was it a procedure?
Well,
like an amputation.
It was for scurvy.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, okay.
So Dr. James Lind sought out to find a viable treatment for scurvy. So he came face to face with the condition while working on a ship as a surgeon in 1747.
Old school ship.
Yeah.
Like a galleon sort of thing. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and...
Wow, that sets the scene then, yeah.
And this was kind of accident how he found the antidote for scurvy.
In the 1700s, scurvy would have been fairly ripe, particularly on, galleon, seafaring ships, the old maritime condition, isn't it?
And this particular ship that he was on was... it didn't have a lot of... medical supplies or anything.
Well, no, they wouldn't take that stuff with them normally, would they?
And scurvy was going all over the ship.
Yeah.
So he had 12 sailors, all with scurvy, and, like I say, very limited supplies. So he took it upon himself to have 6 groups of 2. So put them in couples, and he gave each couple basically what was on the ship to see if anything would work.
Right, okay, yeah.
So... I've got what he gave them here. So he gave one couple vinegar.
Right.
He gave another couple cider.
Right.
He gave another couple barley water.
Right.
He gave another couple... I don't know why I didn't write it down. It was something mixed with water. Anyway. I've got 4 out of the 5 written down. And then he gave another couple oranges and lemons, and obviously oranges and lemons were the only ones that had an effect. because of the vitamin C.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So that was how they discovered the solution to battle scurvy, was this guy just took it upon himself to do that.
Okay. And
that was, yeah, like I say, the first kind of recorded clinical trial in modern times. And Clinical Trials Day is held on May 20th every year to commemorate the day that Dr. Lindt began the trials.
Oh, right, okay, yeah, fair enough.
So it was. Maybe. There was also the mortality rate of the scurvy among the sailors was obviously
quite really, high, I would imagine.
Really
yeah.
bad.
Yeah.
yeah. So that's the first one. That's all I got on that. And I'm going to give you a brief history before we get into the awesome stories of human trials.
Okay,
and
yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I say it like, I always say it's boring. But some people don't find it boring, but I'm just going to run through some history. So first, placebo.
Oh.
Also important factors in clinical trials. You're going to see the history of the clinical trials ramping up as I go through this.
Yeah, so, well, I guess this would have had to have been a fair amount of time after the first clinical trial for them to even actually come up with the idea of a placebo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got to convince people that you're giving them something that is going to make them better. For it to be a placebo.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Do you want to take a guess at when placebos were invented?
Since I was about 100 years out the first time, I'm going to go with my first guess around, you know, mid to late 19th century, the 1800s.
Yeah, early 1800s.
Early 1800s. Oh, okay. It was a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. So placebos. Placebos are a powerful...
Handwriting's good, isn't it?
I know. That's so random that, like, if you look at my notes, I've also gone for extremely small writing on this bit, and my own words trip me up because I'm doing so much research and typing it out and writing it out. So placebos are a powerful tool in clinical trials, making it easier to assess the genuine impact of a drug. This term first entered the landscape in the early 1800s, including the 1811 edition of Hooper's Medical Dictionary. However, the first use of a placebo in a clinical trial didn't occur until 1863, when Dr. Austin Flint coordinated a 13-person trial for rheumatism that involved a placebo. Oh, what does rheumatism mean, Josh? I hear you cry. Well,
you want me to tell you what rheumatism is?
No, I've got it written down.
Okay, you go for it then.
I asked Alexa. And Alexa told me that rheumatism is any disorder of the extremities or back that includes pain or stiffness.
Joints, yeah.
Joints, yeah. Rheumatism, arthritis and things like that. Because I'd heard rheumatism before and I was like, I'm going to double check this. So I just asked her. She told me. So I was like, repeat, writing it down.
Yeah, no, it's right. I kind of suffer it from myself. My right knee is pretty bad for rheumatism.
Yes. And Federal Food, Drug and the Cosmetic Act of 1938. This is not to do with placebos anymore. This is the next section. After the sulfur craze of 1937, where sulfamide drugs were produced in mass without oversight, leading to 107 deaths relating to improperly prepared sulfur, the government replaced the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906 with the Federal Food, Drug and Cosmetic Act of 1938. It outlined requirements for new drugs to ensure a safety before releasing them to the market.
Yeah, I would imagine, yeah. They probably thought that sulfur was the new wonder drug and just put far too much of it into everything and poisoned people with it, didn't they?
Yeah. And I also had to look that up because I was reading that as sulfur and I'm like, sulfur? As in devils and demons, sulfur, like burning. And it's slightly different. Sulfur, S-U-L-F-A.
Oh, right, okay. Oh, not sulfur as in produced from a volcano.
No.
Like the eggy smell stuff, no?
No, no, it's some sort of chemical. So,
I wonder if that's made from sulfur.
Could be.
Could be.
So the next big part of the history is the first double-blind clinical trial in 1943.
A double-blind clinical trial?
Oh, yes. Even the doctors didn't know who had the placebos.
Just Chucked them in a hat, mixed them up, and went, here you go. We'll see what works.
Mad, isn't it? What's crazy is they've done that for a long time and still do it to this day.
Do they?
Yeah.
Well, the doctors don't even know who's got the placebo and who's got the actual chemical that they're testing.
In some cases, yeah. So this is groundbreaking.
What does that prove?
Right. So it started for looking for a treatment for the common cold. The Medical Research Council, the MRC, not to be confused with My Chemical Romance, the MRC in the UK conducted the first double-blind clinical trial. A strict process ensured the treating physician and patient weren't aware of whether the target treatment, Patulin, which is a penicillin patulium extract, was being administered. Oh my God, why have I picked this subject?
You kind of trumped yourself with pharmaceuticals, didn't you?
Well,
carry on.
So while the study itself didn't prove Patulin as an effective option, it did serve as a foundation for future double-blind clinical trials.
So presumably, this double-blind, just so I can get it straight in my head, there will be an overseer. Mm-hmm. That has distributed the placebo or the drugs or whatever that they're doing.
Yep.
But then there are physicians underneath this overseer that are administering these drugs.
Yep.
They don't know what they're administering.
Yep.
And the patient obviously doesn't know whether they're getting a placebo or the real thing either.
Yes, yeah.
And it's only the overseer that's recording the results that will actually have that information.
But what I read was in most cases of double-blind trials, it's never anything like risky or anything like that. Because obviously, to some degree, the doctor, it needs to be safe, doesn't it?
Yeah,
you can't have the doctor completely knowing or not knowing and stuff like that. So it is very, very strict. And it's, like I say, for the common cold, so tablets and things like that.
Yeah.
So it sounds worse than it actually is. And then we go, if you thought double-blind clinical trials weren't bad enough, first randomized trial in 1946.
Go on, because all I can imagine is the overseer himself now doesn't know what's going on.
Who knows? So I've just got to credit this person called Sir Ronald A. Fisher. His name pops up as being the first unofficial credited person to come up with randomized trials.
Okay.
So while randomization was initially introduced as a concept in 1923, it wasn't until 1946 that the first randomized curative controlled clinical trial took place. The MRC conducted a streptomycin trial, which was highly systematic in nature. Using allocation, concealment, and objective monitoring approaches, improving the quality of the collected data. The strategy, while breaking the norm, quickly became the framework for clinical trials moving forward. And this was done by Sir Geoffrey Marshall, who first done the experiment. So Ronald A. Fisher mentioned it in 1923, but Geoffrey Marshall was the first to actually do it in 1946. So both of their names are kind of credited towards it.
Okay. So it's randomised and systematic in nature.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's not an oxymoron at all, is it?
I'm not going to lie to you. Some of it doesn't make sense to me.
Why am I not surprised? I'll just copy that down blindly and read it out for everybody.
Yeah, because
someone might make sense of it.
Yeah. So I'll credit the website vial.com. It kind of broke down the history of clinical trials.
Right.
So I just put this in here because I thought someone out there will know what I'm talking about. And it's part of the history of the clinical trial. So I don't necessarily know what half of it means.
No.
But I feel like I have to mention it. I can't just give examples of crazy clinical trials and be like, oh, that's the podcast, everyone. What do you think? I kind of wanted to present history and stuff like that.
That's fair enough. You could have looked into actually how it works and told us.
I don't want a two-parter on it, mate. Come on. Well, this one I do know a bit more about. The Nuremberg Code of 1947.
Ah.
So during World War II, horrific unscientific and non-consensual experiments were performed on prisoners by the Nazis. So I've got an example of here. The Angel of Death.
Yeah.
Joseph Rudolf Mengele.
Yeah.
Potentially the world's biggest piece of shizer.
Yes.
That has
he
ever lived.
Actually liked inflicting pain on people.
Yes.
And he would perform operations and experiments that were very unethical.
Yes, yes, 100%.
Yeah, 100% enjoyed doing it as well. Yeah, he deserved his reputation for the Angel of Death.
You honestly could do a whole podcast on...
Yes, you could.
The Angel of Death.
Because, he worked predominantly in, like, concentration camps and stuff like that. And the appalling work that he did was
just horrible. Actually one of the lead doctors, what's the other one, like physicians, of Auschwitz.
Yes.
And he had a say in who would get gassed and who wouldn't.
He
also had a, not to make this a podcast about him, but just quickly, he had an obsession with twins.
Yeah, he did,
and
I'm
not
going
to go into the gory details of that, but that is some of the worst stuff I've ever heard. And the fact that he enjoyed doing that thing is crazy to me.
He'd walk around the place whistling to himself.
Yeah, yeah. And in
that's how much, how offset his moral compass was.
Yeah, like he's up there with Hitler.
Probably
worse in some
ways. Yeah, like, I'd say probably worse.
Because
he
focused on children.
Because at least Hitler had a political agenda. He was just doing it for the fun of it.
Yes, yeah, and it's real scary.
Yeah.
So while the Nuremberg trials were underway, a separate doctor's trial was held specifically for physicians who conducted said experiments. So Dr. Leo Alexander outlined 6 points that later became 10 that defined genuine medical research, giving the War Crimes Council a basis for assessing the actions of the physicians on trial in regards to their treatment of prisoner human subjects. So those points became known as the Nuremberg Code, creating an official, broadly accepted set of guidelines for what medical research should or shouldn't involve. Some of these points include voluntary and informed consent, the ability for patients to exit studies, and no unnecessary physical or mental harm.
So this came after the end of the war then?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, what did you say, 47? Yeah, a couple of years after the end of the war. Yeah, that's
so
good.
The Angel of Death was pretty much the reason why this happened.
Yeah.
Because it is honestly shocking stuff. So now that is the kind of old history.
So that's the history done.
We're now into modern times history. So, well, kind of. There's a mixture.
We're talking late 20th century and up to nowadays. Yeah,
90s and more recent times. So nowadays we obviously use clinical trials for vaccines, drugs, dietary choices, dietary supplements and medical devices.
Yes.
Trials now are conducted only after they have received health authority or ethics committee approval in the country where approval of the therapy is sought. These authorities are responsible for vetting the risk to benefit ratio of the trial. Their approval does not mean the therapy is safe or effective, only that the trial may be conducted.
Yeah.
So this is usually conducted with volunteers or willing participants into small pilot studies, and they're in different phases of 1, 2, and 3, depending on the risk and the procedure and stuff like that.
So yeah, people are usually, well, in some of these trials, obviously, have to sign non-disclosure agreements to say that they can't talk about it, and they have to sign like waivers and stuff to say.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
You know, they're not responsible, or the trial is not necessarily responsible. If something does go wrong, they may get compensation, they may not, you never know.
Yeah, 100%. And costs for clinical trials can range, costs for drugs and things can range into billions for
approved drugs.
I think everybody knows this information, but I'm just
big money in pharmaceuticals. Yeah.
Yeah. So
which we are going to be covering in an episode.
Yes. Fairly soon. Which is why I didn't want to go too much into the pharmaceutical companies and things. Yeah. It was more about the actual trials and
what happens in them. Yeah.
So all approved drugs take 11 to 14 years to complete.
Does it take that long? Okay.
Yeah. I know there's going to be people going, what about COVID? Well, they rushed those vaccines. I'll get to that. Don't worry.
There's a number of other procedures and stuff that I can think of off the top of my head that are quite questionable on those facts as well.
But I will get into that because it's a grey area, but it somewhat makes sense.
I'll
get to it. So I found this a little bit strange. So the sponsor may be governmental or an organization or a pharmaceutical, biotechnology or medical device company. Certain functions necessary to the trial, such as monitoring lab work, may be managed by an outsourced partner, such as contract research organizations, laboratories or even universities. Does that make sense?
So the pharmaceutical developer are handing over the research, the tests and the research to outside bodies to do that.
Yeah.
Those tests for them. Yeah.
Yes.
Only after they've got FCC approval or whatever governing body it is.
Yeah. So only 10% of all drugs started in human clinical trials become approved drugs.
Oh, right.
Only 10%, okay. Which I thought was very low.
It is.
Seems low. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. So
I would imagine that quite a lot of drugs are, I'm not a chemist, but are very similar to each other in their sort of molecular makeup.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine that 10% are the ones that are effective.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the other ones that might be only slightly similar, that are slightly dissimilar in their molecular makeup, don't do what they're asked to do. It's like the difference between basically cough syrup and crystal meth.
Right.
Honestly, like the molecular makeup is not that far different.
Wow.
It's all coming from the same source, the pseudoephedrine. Yeah. If it's processed one way, it can turn into crystal meth, which is obviously, a narcotic.
Yeah.
And the other way, it turns into, cough medicine.
Oh, so like the bath salts as well. People were saying bath salts were a few chemicals away from being meth.
Yeah. It was like a few, probably about 10 years ago here in the UK, there was, I know this is going off topic completely, but there was like different chemical makeups for very close to cocaine. Going around, but it was basically just plant food that had been altered on its molecular level. And it was just like a few chemicals, elements different from it, which made it illegal. And it did a similar job to cocaine, but it wasn't the same.
I know the one you're talking about.
The government had to go through and reclassify certain chemical makeups to make sure they fell into the category A, narcotic.
And they started banning certain plant foods and things.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's what I'm putting that 10% down to, is because only 10% of what they're testing, they think it'll work, but only 10% is actually on the money,
And that actually segues into partly the reason, you've already kind of said it, as to why the COVID jabs were kind of rushed, as they said.
Yeah.
and they were produced in under a year. Mm-hmm. Like you said about the similar chemicals and things, it's because they had, well, everybody's heard of SARS.
Yeah.
And SARS is actually very similar to COVID. So they've already had 50 years of research to do with SARS. And then when they combined all of that research with the, obviously, the rush and the need for this pandemic and things.
They'd already got the protein change that they needed.
Yes,
to,
they were pretty much already there. So that kind of allowed them to justify releasing
They could discount 90% of what they knew was wrong and just focus on...
Yes, 100%. Yeah, so that is why it didn't take 11 to 14 years for the COVID jam.
Yeah.
But it's obviously been researched for over 50 years.
There we go on the microphone.
So when it comes to healthy trials... medical trials. Healthy subjects with no pre-existing medical conditions... Unless clinical trials are for a specific disease or issue, such as diabetes or asthma, because would obviously need those people with those conditions.
Yeah, with that condition, yeah.
The main two goals for medical trials nowadays are effectiveness and safety. The benefits must outweigh the risks.
Yeah, that's
simple. People over 55 tend to be the cutoff point for medical trials. They do medical trials for, you know, there's certain medications that when you get elderly you do need, so they do trials on like 70-year-olds and things like that.
Yeah,
but statistically it's 55 is the cutoff point.
Yeah, and cause I would imagine most illnesses or medical conditions, if you're going to contract them, you will have done by 55.
Yes, it's the greater health issues and the drug use complicate data.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they could also obviously have been on tablets for whatever years and things. Mm-hmm. And it goes without saying, obviously, pregnant women are excluded from medical trials, and children.
I don't know what is the age, 18 or is it 21 or 25?
18. Yeah. I'm not too sure, but there might be some exclusions if it's, I assume if it's like a children's medication or something, maybe, I don't know. But from the research, pregnant women and children don't do medical trials.
No, it's fair enough. I know we do hear, don't we, occasionally of just sort of random out there medical trials. Like the lad who had extreme, epilepsy.
Yes, yeah.
And was prescribed marijuana by the doctor. Mm-hmm. To actually combat it, even though it was like an illegal trial, it worked, and so the courts went, "Yeah, okay, fair enough. He's allowed to have it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we'll allow this." But that's a very, very rare case.
I'm impressed that that's two drugs you've mentioned today on this podcast. Like,
oh, narcotic drugs. Yeah, I know. But...
crystal meth, marijuana, three,
and cocaine.
You're on a hat trick. If the sponsor cannot obtain enough test subjects at one location, investigators at other locations are recruited to join the study. So then they will pay for your travel to go to these studies and these trials. Conflict of interest with certain medical trials. So National Institutes of Health make all trials to be registered at clinicaltrials.gov. Does that make sense? That's to avoid conflict of interest, including like big pharmaceutical companies and things like that. So basically every trial and every drug that they're testing, once they get the...
It has to be centralized. So you haven't got two big pharmaceutical companies running the same test effectively on different groups of people coming out with effectively trying to get the same result. But
you have to register everything. So everything is proper like safety. Gone over. Most clinical trials these days do pay for travel and accommodation with a small cash incentive or a large cash incentive, as most volunteers don't do it for the money, but they want to help in the name of science.
Money's going to be a contributing factor there.
Yeah. But you do get it. You do get some people that they just volunteer and go for like a more safer trial. because maybe they've had someone affected by a certain condition. So they're like, no, I want to help out and find the solution and the antidote or whatever. So, yeah, but I would say you're right. Most people do it for the money. And I will just say, I'm not promoting this. I'm not saying everyone go out and sell your body to science. I just found this interesting.
It's not a get-rich-quick scheme, is it?
No, certainly not. At the end of the day. But I'm going to talk money, and I'm going to give you some statistics and things. So the highest one-off payment that I could find online for a trial that was 3 days was £4,200.
Wow.
Which I'm not sure on the exchange rates these days, but maybe $5,000, US dollars.
Yeah, maybe.
£100 a day with potential to earn thousands is considered the majority of these trials.
Yeah?
It's roughly £100 a day is
Sign
what most
up.
Of them are offering. Yeah. 5% are students.
Yeah, yeah, I would imagine they are, yeah.
And
need the money, don't they?
Yeah. And you cannot do a medical trial whatsoever if you are a smoker or a drinker.
Oh, well, that's me, ain't it?
Yeah, they won't accept you.
Yeah, sorry. Pirates around the world, no good for medical trials.
No. There is something called First Man In, which is a certain trial, which you are the first person to ever take the drug.
Oh, patient and, zero, okay.
And that pays extremely well, as it's only ever been tested on animals, and you are the first human.
Yeah, so yeah, that, I would imagine that would pay quite well. Yeah.
So that could be £2,000 for like 1 day's work.
Yeah, like you say, I guess the higher the money, the higher the risk, isn't it?
Yeah, and in some cases as well, it goes based on how long the trial is going to be. So you could get more money, like sleep trials. That's actually next on here. So sleep studies, where you are literally paid to sleep, but in some cases, you can't get a result unless it's been a matter of weeks.
Right,
you know what I mean? If you're measuring like heart rates and stress and nightmares, whatever it might be, they might keep you in there for like a minimum of 30 days. So you will get paid, you say, £100 a day or whatever. So sometimes it's the length of the trial that you actually earn more money, not the risk.
Yeah, fair enough.
So yeah, I've said first man in trials. You've got sleep studies. That's relatively safe. You've also got little trials where, like for baby shampoo, you would get paid to basically pour chemicals in your eyes to see if it makes you cry.
Johnson & Johnson, no more tears. Yeah.
So
I remember the days when shampoo really used to sting your eyes if it got in there.
Yeah. Think of all them poor people that are now probably blind from testing. Yeah, so there's trials like that where you can do things, putting chemicals in your eyes and make sure it's baby-proof. Most trials of drugs that had side effects were harmless, with the usual nausea, fainting, headaches. But in 2017, two students who took part in a trial at Northumbria University were accidentally given a dose of caffeine equivalent to 300 cups of coffee in one hit.
Wow. Did they survive? Yeah,
they did survive, but they were fighting for their lives.
I'll bet.
And the university was fined for £400,000 for the error.
I'm not surprised. They say that literally like 150 coffees in a day is like a lethal dose for some people.
Yeah, and their hearts were
going into palpitations.
They did go into critical care for a long time, but they did actually both survive.
They pulled through. Fair play to them.
There's no follow-up on whether they got compensation or anything like that, but I think it's safe to say
they probably did.
Yeah. Whether you signed a thing or not, I imagine if you come close to death, that's because they were told as well it's one of those easy trials. You'll just walk in, you'll be in there a day, and I think I read they both got offered like £200 or something each,
For the initial test.
Yeah, and I think it was a tablet, so it was literally one of those things where it was like, oh yeah, you'll be in and out in a day. And they didn't
tablet a Pro Plus with 300 espressos in it.
They didn't expect it to take that kind of turn. Showing you the bad side of these things. Also, in America, I couldn't find anything on the UK, but I assume it's the same, because I assume it's the same guidelines.
Right.
You have to wait at least 30 days between trials. so you can't go to one pace,
yeah,
get paid.
I would imagine so, yeah.
But there is an interesting fella who I saw an interview on. His name is Yoshi. I think it's Orishari. Yoshi Orishari.
Right.
He was very naughty, and he used to do that, and he used to go from state to state, because obviously states in America have different
jurisdictions,
and they don't talk to
yeah.
each other. So he would go from one state, and then the next day he may or may not have gone to another one and done a clinical trial, gone to another state, and he would spend 2 weeks holiday from his job just going to multiple places and earning extra cash. But he has said...
That's going to be dangerous, though, isn't it?
He has said, because I think he's now like in his 40s.
Mm.
He has said now that there are a few side effects that he thinks is from the testing and
well,
the
yeah,
drugs.
Well, yeah, yeah. If you're not giving yourself that time to flush it all out of your system before you put
yeah.
something else in there, yeah, you are opening yourself up to tragedy, really.
But in recent years, with anyone that does a medical trial, they make sure you have like a yearly medical checkup where they completely
full
check
medical,
everything.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, which is the least they can do.
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
yeah. Now, the worst case, because I wanted to find the worst case trial I could find online.
Right.
Because I don't want people to think I'm sat here saying, yeah, it's not a bad option if you want extra cash. I'm not saying that at all.
No, you're not at all.
So I've got the worst story to try and put you off it, in case you are thinking about doing it.
Right.
Have you heard of the Elephant Man trials?
What, John Merrick?
No, no, it's just called the Elephant Man trials.
Okay, so, yeah, fair enough. Then.
Not the Elephant Man. No. Very confusing. I shouldn't have asked you that question, to be honest. I think most people have heard of the Elephant Man, but not the trials. So in northwest London, in March 2006... 8 young healthy men participated in a clinical trial for the drug TGN-1412, which was a tablet.
Right.
Within 16 hours, all 8 men had been transferred to intensive care. The drug TGN-1412 was intended to treat leukemia and had already been successfully tested on monkeys, but never on humans. The first man right. within an hour was fighting for his life.
Do monkeys get leukemia?
I don't know. I've got no idea.
Okay, but don't let me tangent off on the sidetrack like that, because we're already running for time. So. Yeah.
So the first man within an hour was fighting for his life. He experienced vomiting, screaming and pain. He was fainting, temperature soared, organs were failing, and his body swelled up so severely that newspapers around the world dubbed this the Elephant Man Trials.
Fair play.
They'd done this all for £2,000. That's what they were promised.
Right.
And that's the worst case I could find. That's it. Just
is that all they got as well? They didn't get any extra for compensation or anything like that of nearly dying?
They probably did, yeah. That's the thing is I couldn't find any real follow-ups, because I don't know if it's all like enclosed or it's like...
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? Because, yeah, they were paid £2,000. It's research. They know what they're getting into when they mm-hmm. sign that piece of paper to say, yeah, I'll do it for £2,000.
Yeah.
So potentially, they probably didn't actually get more than that.
No, and because the information is protected, isn't it? So
yeah.
That's probably why there's not much information on the aftermath of it.
Yeah.
But they did survive.
Yeah, well, so, that was good.
But came very, very close to death. And that is my little presentation on trials. So I've got one question for you. Trials, would you take part?
To be honest, I think it depends what the trial is and what it's for and how much they're paying. Mm. But as we've already discovered that pirates are not acceptable for medical
yeah, you couldn't do it
trials.
If you wanted to.
I wouldn't be able to do it anyway because I drink far too much rum. But yeah, I think potentially, because I have seen the adverts online and in newspapers years and years ago and thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, I don't meet the criteria of what they're looking for. They will,
yeah, yeah.
Like when they release an advert saying we want test subjects for medical, they will list requirements. You know, you must be a woman between 18 and 35, you know, blah, 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 or whatever it is. But yeah, I have been tempted in the past. I think if I was unemployed and a little bit hard up, I'd definitely give it a go, to be honest. Mm. And I'd probably lie on my application to say, no, I don't drink, no.
Don't give people ideas, no. Well, I would say a big fat no from me. The only one I'd be interested in is the sleep one, where you literally do nothing.
Yeah.
I get paid to sleep, and you monitor my brain and heart. Sounds good to me. So yeah, that's the only one I'd do.
I don't know. Well, I'd probably be a little bit more liberal about it. If you know, I just want to test this drug. What do I got to do? I just got to sit there, take an injection in the arm, and 4 hours later, if you feel fine, you can go home. $2,000 richer. Yeah, I'll do that. Mm. You know,
the only thing that worries me is I feel like I'm the kind of person that I'd get the placebo and I'd be freaking out like, ah! And the doctor would be like, mate, you had a placebo, and it'd be all in my head and stuff. Like, I'd be paranoid about it. So no,
to be honest, the worst thing that could happen to me, I think, is they give me a tablet or an injection or something, and all my hair falls out.
Oh,
that would be literally the worst.
You do love your hair.
I do.
Your luscious locks. Nah, it's not good.
That would be the worst one. I think anything else I could probably cope with.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how we put this to the paranormality scale, because it is an actual science thing and it does happen.
It does happen. It's true. It's not really paranormality scalable, is it?
No, no.
Well, let's put it. How likely? Right. Let's create a scenario on a scale of 1 to 10. How likely would you be to go to a test? Not sleeping.
Mm.
It is a chemical, say, pill.
Okay, tablet is more acceptable, yeah.
For, what should we say?
Flu?
Chronic indigestion.
Okay, yeah, all right.
Yeah?
I do get indigestion.
So you're getting paid £1,000 for one day's trial. They're going to give you indigestion, so you're going to get fed. They're going to try and ease your indigestion with an overdose of Reni Rappies or whatever it is that they've got. All right, so what on 1 to 10, how likely would you be to take that trial?
Quick question. Is there Pepto-Bismol or actual Reni on the side just in case it doesn't work?
No.
Okay. Honestly, I give it a 1.
Really?
Yeah, it scares me. I really don't like the idea of putting anything in my body and stuff that I don't know what the outcome could be. Like, I don't know.
£1,000 for a slap-up meal and a tablet to get rid of the indigestion?
I don't know. Yeah.
I'm looking at, 7 out of 10 for that.
But then is it minimal risk? That's the thing. If they've done their research and they say to you, it's minimal risk,
yeah, it'd be fairly minimal risk.
If they gave me a list of side effects and they were all mild, then, yeah, I suppose I probably would maybe a 6.
All right, so the side effects that they know of so far are, 1, it doesn't stop the indigestion.
Mm.
2, prolific sweating.
Mm.
3, really bad flatulence.
Okay, well, I've got 2 out of 3 already. So. okay, right. If that is the situation...
Yeah, it's £1,000. You're going to get fed. You're going to get a trial for... what did I say? Chronic indigestion.
Yeah, yeah.
And the only side effects are... Yeah, it doesn't stop it. Sweating or flatulence. £1,000 for a day's work. Not even work, is it? You've just got to eat a meal and try a pill.
If that's the case, I'm giving it a 6.5.
6.5?
Yeah. I'd still be a bit hesitant.
I'm still about 7 on that, so we'll say 6.75.
Yeah, that's all right. That's fair. All right. So that was a weird paranormality scale, but that's the best we could do.
Yeah, we're making it up as we go along now.
We've gone back to the old days.
How much we like it. We don't really like medical trials, but if this scenario presented itself, maybe.
Yeah. And I would just like to mention, before we wrap up, another reason why I thought of doing the medical trials and things is we've all been affected by someone who has had cancer or passed away from cancer. And me and my two buddies, Tony and Dave, we've signed up for the 5K for the Race for Life. And we want to raise some money for cancer research. And it's not until June. It's like June 9th, I think.
Is there an online form that people can come along and sponsor you for that?
Yes, I'll sort out a link. It's all online and everything.
Okay, well,
we're doing that.
That's our one single call to action this week then. Please, everybody at home, come and support Josh for his, what was it, a run?
Yeah, Race for Life 5K.
Race for Life 5 kilometres.
Yes, and I've only ever successfully done 3. So I'm pushing myself.
Don't sponsor too much.
No. I'm definitely doing it because, like I say, I'm on a diet and I'm going to the gym and working out more. And I've got till June. So I've got like another 4 or 5 months to.
The diet is kind of working as well.
Thanks, mate.
The hamster cheeks.
No, I am slowly slimming down. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm definitely going to do it. I'm pushing myself and it's a challenge. And my two buddies are doing it with us. And. Doing it with me.
I'll make sure you got a GoPro so that you can actually film yourself doing it. And we'll provide a link in the description. Please follow the link, sponsor Josh. That's the only thing you got to do this week. And until next time, I've been Pirate.
I'm Josh.
This has been Paranormality UK. Ta-ta.
Ta-ta, baby.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in...
opinions.
We do that in every episode, too.
We're professional, unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.